WHQR Public Media. This is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us for a special Juneteenth episode. 3 years ago, I sat down with Joe Conway, who was, at the time, the City of Wilmington's Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer and a WHQR board member. We talked about Juneteenth, which had, for the first time, become a City of Wilmington holiday 2 years after then-President Joe Biden made it a federal holiday in 2021. The holiday celebrates the day, June 19, 1865, when the U.S. Army delivered the news to enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, that they were free. It was, notably, 2.5 years after Lincoln gave the Emancipation Proclamation. It's seen by historians as effectively the end of slavery in the Confederacy. Juneteenth, also called Freedom Day, has been celebrated in parts of the Black community for a long time, but it wasn't more widely known. In 2023, the holiday was still gaining traction, and you could easily bump into people who had just heard about Juneteenth, or who hadn't heard about it yet at all. 3 years later, I wanted to talk about how the resonance and symbolism of Juneteenth has, or hasn't, sunk in. I also wanted to talk about how Juneteenth, as a federal holiday that was becoming more widely understood and celebrated, came out of a particular cultural moment where the nation and its institutions were reflecting on and, in many cases, re-examining the past. Our current moment, just a few years later, well, it looks a little different. Joe, who is now the Director of Community Health and Engagement at UNC Health, was good enough to come back into the WHQR studio and revisit our conversation about Juneteenth, which is, of course, also about identity and history and the relationship between those two. Well, Joe Conway, thank you very much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So we had a conversation about Juneteenth 3 years ago when you were at the City of Wilmington. You're now at UNC Health.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask, do you feel like that message is sinking in? Juneteenth's been a federal holiday for 5 years, and I think a lot of people were still discovering it when we spoke in 2023. So where are things with that now?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Ben, it all depends on who you ask, where in the country you're asking that question too. So it become a federal holiday or became a federal holiday, I believe, in 2021. Am I correct with
yes.
that? Yeah. So when I think about that, outside of Wilmington, I think it's still fairly new and people are processing. And then you get asked the questions of why do we need to do this? Why is it important? There is a gap in the American history knowledge. And I would definitely ask folks to dig into that a little deeper so that they can understand the implications of where our country was post-Civil War and really all the way up to 1865, right? Wilmington has a different answer.
Yeah.
Because we, about 4 months or so before Galveston, specifically here in New Hanover County, our African-American folks were freed. Somewhere right in that general area. And then Galveston gets its notification, right? And then they're freed. But then 1898 happens. So freely you have received and freely someone's going to take it away. So you get to the coup d'etat in Wilmington, and it almost took away the very thing that African Americans were given. There's a rub there. There is a, when I used to sing back in the day, there's a dissonant chord there that doesn't, it sounds kind of off. Like, whoa, wait a minute. And so if you were to ask Wilmingtonians, is Juneteenth valuable? Is it needed? Should we be out there celebrating like some of the celebrations going on during that week? Absolutely. Is it raw? Yes. There's two stories here at two different points in our nation's history, but specifically in this particular area, New Hanover County, Wilmington, southeastern North Carolina. So I do think on one hand, you have folks that are all for it, resonate with it, and then you still have other folks that I would say even in this area that don't get it.
Yeah. I think part of what you're touching on is that there's no moment that I can point to in American history where we're like, we perfected freedom for all people, right? No. And specifically when we're talking about race relations, there's no moment I would point to as like, oh, well, that fixed it. Some people do. Some people will be like, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation fixed it, or the Civil Rights Act fixed it. I mean, it's a process, and there's setbacks. It's hard to find a more profound setback than 1898 in Wilmington if you're charting the course of the goal to give all people full freedom.
Right.
I think that's what puts a little bittersweetness on Juneteenth. Is that where you're getting at?
Definitely. I think we need to understand just when we think we got it all together. And I don't care at what point in history you wanna point to. I love the fact that you brought up the civil rights. Well, if the Emancipation fixed everything, then we shouldn't have needed the civil rights. Well, if the 13th Amendment and then the subsequent 14th Amendment, I mean, if it fixed everything, we shouldn't have needed civil rights. Civil rights came and went, and there were some definite victories. Okay, we have, and we know, even at the federal level right now, there's some pushback on the DEI, right? It was here. I do think there's aspects of DEI that were inappropriately used. It was not a law. It was built upon laws to help inform the people and to start shaping a culture. Some were skillful at how that was done. Some weren't. And so that pushback from the minority voices in the DEI world, and when I say minority, I'm not talking about the black and brown people or the women or the LGBTQ community. I'm talking about the minority voice that was at the table by way of our melanin deficient folks, who I would probably put in that minority category in this particular case, because there was this unsettling feeling and they rose up. Right? Had we done it a little bit better, had we done it right, perhaps we wouldn't have needed even DEI because it was fixed, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think some of what you're talking about, and I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of people over the last 5 years about this, is usually a white person, often a white guy, but not always, who felt like they had done nothing wrong and that they thought of themselves as having fairly egalitarian views on the world. And all of a sudden, they're being pilloried for racism writ large, everything is their fault. And because you're laying at their feet patriarchy and racism and a whole host of other structural issues, capitalism, whatever else is being piled on, and they just felt assaulted out of nowhere. They're sort of blindsided.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think the pushback came from those people. I think sometimes pushback came from genuine racists who were unhappy that they'd been called out, that they were still doing the same kind of stuff, just in a subtler way, and they had been spotted.
Right.
But I do think there were some cases where an artful practitioner of DEI could get to that person in a way that wouldn't push them away from the conversation.
Yeah.
And some people just came in like a bull in a china shop.
Yeah. And those requirement mandates, mandating education and those kinds of things. So, Benny, you're getting a little bit into my past, and I want to have respect for that. I'm very passionate about where I took DEI in my world. I took it to the brain science. I took it to neuroscience, neuroplasticity, trauma-informed leadership, those kinds of things. Those were so important because it set the playing field on the brain and not necessarily the color of the skin or a person's upbringing, although we're going to talk about that and why our brains process and have the neural pathways already built to address that. And a lot of it is part of those heuristics, we quick patterns so that we can all live day to day, those kinds of things. So it's important to take, the fault, even with, my racist friends out there and even pro-black families as well, as everybody's happy to talk about themselves and their culture. But I think the thing that they've got to understand, we've got to understand, let me put myself in the day, we've got to understand is that nuance. How do I make space for Ben to be who Ben is, how his family raised him, and for Ben to walk into discovery on his own accord as opposed to force him a particular direction?
Exactly. Yeah, I think that was the rubric for success, was getting people to come to the project willingly instead of saying,
yes,
this is now being imposed on you. This is the new thought regime. You have to think this way.
Yes.
We hope you think this way. It's different than you have to think this way.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, you nailed it.
So I want to talk about, and you alluded to this, so I want to get into it, with the recent Supreme Court ruling on the Voting Rights Act. kind of cut right to the core of this, right? Because the Voting Rights Act essentially is built on the premise of racism being real and active and existing and requiring congressional action to prevent it from keeping black people from having their vote, from participating fully in a democracy.
Yep.
And the argument against it is basically we don't need that anymore, which is a way of saying we beat racism. We won, and because that's not needed anymore, this is now an overcorrection. That case is not an isolated one. It's part of a broader conversation about the non-existence of racism the way it was in, say, the 1950s.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is true. If you look at the 1950s, we do not see the Klan in the streets. Occasionally some Proud Boys, but not the Klan. Like, sheriffs in North Carolina were active members of the Klan, and it was not hidden.
Right.
And, you know, you had, you know, segregated schools and facilities and public transit. I mean, it was right there in your face. And so it seems fair to say it is not like that. But sometimes that's the period at the end of the sentence, and then there's nothing else. It's just we beat racism. Mm. And I think there is a difficulty around talking about subtler forms of racism, systemic forms of racism that aren't right in your face, like
right. The
Klan marching down your main street.
Absolutely.
And that's where I think we see the tension when we have this conversation about, do we still need laws or policies like DEI or just public attitudes about this that are still serving as corrective? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And I think we go back to our history, right? So again, let's go back to emancipation. All right, we'll mark it at 1865, Galveston, Texas. If it took, even in a generation, by the time you get to 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina, if we did not need an emancipation proclamation, as it were, and everybody got it, why by 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina, did they not see the reality of that? Did they not experience the reality? Why were factions allowed to come and basically, you know, burn a city to the ground, at least the African-American portion? And I know it's estimated, there's lots of estimates out there, right? But 60 plus deaths in the African-American community, and then others told to get out of town or something was going to happen. We'll never know what that something was, but that's what happened. Then you move from 1898 out of Wilmington, North Carolina, and then you have, you know, think about even kind of like the Great Migration or African-Americans leaving the South, even though in the North there was still pushback, right? But it was better, at least that was the thought, than it was here in the South. Why? I mean, we had laws on the books coming into play. Then you got the civil rights of the 1960s. We have laws on the books that we are just asking to be enforced. So when you're talking about changing a people, when you're talking about changing a culture, I think it's great to have those aspirations and those laws on the books to help enforce, which is one of the reasons why they're still needed. Because we don't listen very well. Let me just give a brief illustration. The speed limit says 55. I'm just going to be honest with you.
Yeah, I can't say anything on the record, but I think I know what you mean.
I don't want to challenge your audience, but how many of us actually agree and obey it all the time?
Flow of traffic seems to imply,
right. So, but there's a law there, and it's a guide. It's a principle. It's a rule. If we get pulled over and we were going faster than, you know, they've got cameras and all this other kind of stuff and speed traps and so on and so forth. So they pretty much got you nailed. I think we need laws in place, amendments in place to make sure we stay on the rails. Human tendency is always towards chaos. Oh, the whole universe, I mean, from a scientific physics standpoint, we're always going towards chaos. So we have to have something to kind of keep us on the straight and narrow.
Otherwise, entropy just takes us.
You know it. Second law. Is the second law of thermodynamics is entropy?
You know I'm a liberal arts major. I don't know which law is which, but I know it's one of them.
All right.
I take your point. I think the fear is from people in the black community that I've spoken with is we don't need this rule anymore, and we promise nothing bad will happen if we take this rule away.
We have failed on promises.
I feel like the track record is not good, and yeah, I'm a white guy, but I can see if that was me, if that was my community and that was my history and my place in the nation's history, I would be awful skeptical of, you know, trust us.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're nailed it. We have seen too many times broken promises, and it's not just the African-American community. We know our indigenous and native-born folks the same thing. We know some of our Asian folks that came over to help us with rail systems and so on and so forth. You're promised this kind of, you know, house with a white picket fence is the land of opportunity, and some have been able to exact those things. And I know we never expected all to do it. However, some of the battles that have been fought along the way, like even people coming to our country. I mean, why is it the mindset of an individual coming to our country in the early 1900s, 1930, if my memory serves, saying, I want to be declared white? Why? This is someone that's not from our world, not from our, or they're from our world, but they're not from our country. And they're coming into this nation and through the immigration process wants to be declared something that they see clearly of process, there's an advantage to this. And there's two sides to this, right? It's one thing to be declared a particular race on paper per the census, but it's another thing for you to see me face to face. So think about our North African and Middle Eastern cultures who many times when they come to this country are classified as white according to the government. But I'm your neighbor. And when you walk out of your house, you're like, I don't know, Joe spent a lot of time at the beach or something. Right. Because, you know.
Yes, my Eastern European roots. I mean, so this is another conversation which I think is interesting. And we spend a lot of time talking about in the media and in culture, talking about being black and blackness. And there's less conversation about being white and whiteness. Cool. It's the default. It's the, you know, it's the thing that you're not if you're black or Asian, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like it wasn't until really college. I didn't get any of this in high school, where I had professors who were unpacking how the Irish became white, how Greeks became white, how Sicilians became white, because they were certainly not in European culture at one point in time.
Yes.
And that process required abdicating some cultural elements that people were proud of previously.
Yeah.
You had to give something up, but you got something in return. And yes. It's sort of the immigrant's bargain at a certain point.
Yes. Yeah, and those are opportunities to bargain with a federal government that have never been afforded to some of us who arrived on slave ships. I think the other thing that we need to be cognizant as we look at Juneteenth, it is a very unique African-American experience. We have plenty of folks in our country, in our area right here, that were not a part of any slave ship. Their ancestry was not a part of that. They may have just arrived here 4 years ago, and all of a sudden they're lumped into this group, and they're not understanding part of the American struggle of the African-American. So I think there's room and space, and this is where I'm going to keep going back to. How do I let them be who they are? How do I let Ben be who he is and any other, you know, European root person and express that? And how do we come together and have more engaging conversations that may not always end in agreement, but we end up with respect to one another? That is where my heart has always been through DEI, through many of my experiences, even when I was at the hospital over health equity here locally. That has always been my heart, is I don't have to agree with you, but I do have to engage you in conversation and understand your unique perspective. And I cannot unpack anything for you. That's personal work, which is why most people feel as though it's a personal attack.
Yes. It always strikes me that there's a certain degree of, I wasn't invited to the cookout in the pushback against this kind of thing. I think of my experience with other cultures living in New York City. Mm. You know, I went to Fire Island one day. Mm. It was amazing, right? But it is a gay mecca, and I'm a painfully straight guy. And I had a great time, but I got the sense this was not for me.
Yeah,
this wasn't my place. I was a visitor, and I was welcomed warmly, but that's not my place. Yeah. I was a visitor there.
Absolutely.
Or the Puerto Rican Day Parade, right? Absolute blast. I'm not Puerto Rican. Yeah. That's not my day, and I shouldn't be offended that that day is not about me. Not every day is about Ben.
Yes.
And
you're just discovering that.
I'm just now in my mid-40s discovering there's a world outside of my solipsistic self.
Okay.
But no, I see that in the pushback and trying to understand that pushback instead of just condemning it.
Yeah.
sometimes it is just hostile racism is what it is. But sometimes there is this element of, why is this thing here that I don't have access to, that I'm not a part of? This is confusing me. And that, and you see that manifest as frustration.
Yeah. Well, let me give another illustration. I have four adult sons. But between Tiffany and I, there have been 7 pregnancies in our marriage. I will tell you, at no point in time would I want to give birth.
You can just watch that parade from the side.
I can watch that parade from the side, get excited for it, help with the breathing process if that's involved. Although my wife did tell me at one point, stop breathing. I thought that was awkward. Well, I'm gonna pass out. But I think having to be a part of every person's experience all the time, FOMO, I think that's a problem. I can appreciate, you and I had a conversation on the way in here, I can appreciate what you do, the challenges that you have. I don't have to be Ben Shockman or know what's going on through Ben's mind. And I think we need to have that respect for one another. When we feel as though we need to be a part of everybody's life, I think we need to take a good look in the mirror at some point in time and say, what's going on with me? Why do I feel invalidated? Why do I feel of less value to either my family, my friends, my community? What's going on with me? Because I see every person as being an integral part of the conversation and valuable. But I hope they have found that value in themselves. And it's not tied to any one particular thing, but it's tied to a community. Because at the end of the day, none of us lives or dies to ourselves. We all impact each other. The person that got into an accident on 40 last week as I was driving up there, I'm going to tell you right now, there's about 500 of us that are a little bit upset and probably saying in our cars, why can't you drive better? You know, but who knows what was going on in that car? How do we give them space for maybe they were having a heart-related incident, maybe a tire blew? Look, little grace goes a long, long way. We need more grace with each other.
I think that's right. And I think you put your finger on it about trying to find that thing for yourself instead of I want to be part of that. And I do see that when people say, you know, when is straight pride? When is White History Month?
Yeah.
And I go back to this thing about, you know, white being a thing that we have built over the years.
Yeah.
It's, you're not from Whitelandia.
Right.
Right. You might have Norwegian roots or Scottish roots or you people might be from the Caucasus Mountains. Who knows?
Right. Right.
But I find that people who do, you know, the ancestry thing are happier and more self-assured because they've done the work to figure out where they're from. Because white is not a place, and it's such a broad umbrella that it's hard to have a sense of meaning and belonging under that banner.
Yeah. You know, you're bringing up something that is another thing that's near and dear to my heart. So I love the ancestry, 23andMe, all that kind of good stuff, the genome. If you will. And what I want folks to understand is that we are 99.9% the same. You probably have more in common with me than some of my own family members, for instance. And I'm not even talking from a cultural standpoint. I'm talking about on a genetic level. So there's that part. But I think the other thing, too, that I discovered even when I was a DEI officer for the city is, and probably even when I worked for the hospital, and I'm going to just say this direct. I believe some of my white brothers and sisters, they don't know their own history. You're hitting on it, right? And when you don't have anything to tie to other than what Meemaw and Pawpaw told you, but you haven't done the historical digging to understand what that means, that will rock your world a little bit, especially if you're looking for those umbilical cords to attach yourself to help find out who you are. Now, we have a very sensitive generation that's going through it. I don't mean sensitive in a bad way. I mean, they are astute. They are attuned to discovering who they are. And we've watched this shift happen on the census as a result of people discovering this genetic level stuff. You know, oh, I'm a little bit of this. I'm a little bit of that. I used to tell people all the time, we're all mutts. While nobody out here is a thoroughbred, you know, maybe the royalty in England is more thoroughbred.
But that comes with some drawbacks. There's some conditions.
Yeah, there are some definite conditions. So I just think, again, because of this aspect, that even my white brothers and sisters sometimes are not even being told their own history. There's a gap. And all they're trying to do right now, whether it's fight against what they feel as though is being taken away from them, or it's doing a 23andMe study and then going to ask their family questions, they're just trying to discover, to some degree, not all the time, who they are.
I think that's profound. Yeah. So talking about this, you know, going back and learning about your history, Juneteenth came out of this moment. Juneteenth as a federal holiday, as something that was becoming part of the broader national cultural awareness that more people knew about. That all came out of this moment that included a real willingness to go back and learn, sometimes for the first time, sometimes relearn, about history. Yeah. And to reinvestigate, you know, key moments in our history, underreported or underknown or unknown moments in our history. We saw this in pop culture. We saw this in my business, where you had newspapers who are actually going back and re-reporting stuff that they had done because it had been through a lens that excluded so much.
Yeah.
And, you know, not everyone was happy about that, but in general, there seemed to be a permission structure to say, we can go back and reopen that book.
Yeah.
And go back and learn it. And it feels like that moment is coming to a close, or there are forces trying to bring that moment to a close. What do you make of that?
So as long as we have heroes out there that continue to promote Juneteenth and remember it, I think it'll never disappear. It may look dim now. Let me tell you where this really began to hit me yesterday. I was watching news, and I saw on one of the major stations the celebration for Pride Month. And I was like, I'll be damned. They're still doing it, right? There's a major celebration over there on the West Coast. There's a major celebration in the Northeast. And so though certain things are being denied to that community and laws have come out and states are putting things on the books or digging up that old 1800 law just to bring it forward, it's not stopping them. So my inspiration as I began to watch the news yesterday was like, whoa, 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 Juneteenth, we just got here. We just arrived at the party. This is not the time to quit. This is the time that sometimes we allude to our political landscape, we double down, right? I think we, and for many years, all throughout African-American history, there was a lot that we did in our own community. And I think that's the other thing. Sometimes we need to stop waiting for another community to do for us. We need to do for our own community. But history was passed down that way. Standards were passed down that way. Religion and spirituality was passed down in the house, in the home, with our grandparents and our parents and siblings and cousins. And that can still go on. You don't need the city of Wilmington to throw something for Juneteenth. Now, there is a little bit that they will be doing, same with the county, but look where it's coming from. It's coming from those grassroots organizations that want to hold our government officials accountable, right? So I want to encourage people, just the same way I do in my own family, find something about Juneteenth that you can latch on to. Not only that, discover something new about Juneteenth. You know, because there is that transition from 1865, 4 months prior, Wilmington, New Hanover County, we just got the word and then they get it 4 months later. It's so important because we should not, we must not forget, we must pass it down to the next generation so that they know how to govern themselves in the future, now and in the future.
Okay, so we've touched on some heavy stuff.
Okay.
But to end here, I want to ask, you know, Juneteenth, as you point out, is still a thing.
Yes.
So how do you see people celebrating Juneteenth, and how do you celebrate Juneteenth?
Well, I'm already, you know, tap dancing on how I think others should celebrate Juneteenth, and I think it needs to be uniquely them. Some people are going to celebrate by sponsoring or supporting a local minority business. I think that's wonderful. Some people are going to hang the flag. Some people are going to watch some documentaries. Some people are going to attend the barbecue. Hopefully you'll get invited, Ben. But I would actually challenge folks, especially my African-American folks, to invite a unique, diverse population to your barbecue.
Adopt a hunky.
Okay, we'll go that route.
I say that with love.
That's all right. You can say that. I can say on a personal level, it's, you know, we have an empty house, an empty nest now over there off of Masonboro Loop. And so it's usually Tiffany and I, and we typically do the documentary. We have engaging conversations. I can't tell you the number of conversations that especially my wife, who you know is white, will bring up, and she'll ask me, and I've always cautioned her. First of all, black people aren't a monolith, and I do not speak for the entire group.
on behalf of all African Americans.
That's right. There is no flag in my living room, right? But I do give her some things to think about in some spaces that she's walked in. Over our 34 years of marriage, I've coached her and said, you know, I want you to understand, when you said this to this all-black audience, some of the sisters were giving you the side eye, and let me tell you why they were giving you the side eye. So I think that's where I come into play also with my white friends is, hey, let me pull you aside for a second. This is how you could have said that would have landed a little different. But also, I'm also viewed as the enemy because I'm the black guy who's dating a white woman. And I'm the guy who's like, well, you couldn't find yourself a sister. Not necessarily. I've dated everybody, just so that we're clear. But it's a matter of personal introspection for me. What does this mean to me? How do I apply it in my everyday life? How do I look at my ancestors who paid the ultimate price for me to sit across from Ben Shockman at WHQR? That is awe-inspiring. That's humbling. I'm getting a little bit misty-eyed, so ask me another question.
Okay. So, I mean, I think we've covered what I wanted to cover. I think what's fascinating that you just talked about with your conversation with your wife, which I've been married for 20 years, so I can't catch up on you because of how time works.
Right.
I'm like 14 years behind, but I'm working on it. But that relationship and the ability to share, you know, your perspective with someone, that's like the ultimate safe space.
Yeah.
With your life partner.
Yes.
Where you can, if you work at it, be wrong and take it as not as an attack, but as information.
Oh yeah.
That you didn't have before. Context. Yes. You didn't have before. Insight you didn't have before.
Absolutely.
It is really hard to recreate that level of intimacy, you know, with just another person on the street.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly high bar, but it's a great place to start.
Right.
And I think, like, if that's the goal and you're always just working towards that goal, then that's really something.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And just to be clear, it's a two-way street, right? I've been in spaces and she's pulled me aside.
I get pulled aside more, I think, than I pull aside. But that's been good for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I was still the same person I was when I was 18, well, that'd be a disaster.
You're right. All of us.
We'd
right.
all be a disaster. Yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it.
Okay.
Joe Conway, thank you very much for your time.
Ben, it's always great to be with the WHQR family. You have my heart. I listen to you regularly and just keep doing what you're doing, getting the word out and making us think, those engaging conversations, and continue to invite that discourse, if you will, constantly. We need it.
Thanks, man. All right. Well, that's it for this special Juneteenth episode of The Newsroom. Thanks to my guest, Joe Conway, and to WHQR's Ken Campbell for technical assistance. Music for today's show was provided by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.